I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with David Daly, former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, and author of Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and then Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. And that one, Unrigged, is now out in paperback and updated through the 2020 election. And you can also follow Dave on Twitter, at Dave Daly, D-A-L-E-Y, at Dave Daly 3. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. As we continue to confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you all to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, staying home, and by finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation. Now, I assume that listeners to this show and all those who care about democracy are well aware of the challenges presented by gerrymandering, voter suppression, election manipulation, as well as the concerted efforts by Republicans to expand the negative impacts of all three. The Republican Party, its beliefs and its policies, while passionately held by millions, are no longer those of the majority of Americans, and so the only way they can survive, and in fact often dominate, is to game the system. Their voters are more likely to vote, especially in non-presidential elections, and they have strategically exploited that advantage to gerrymander electoral districts and pass laws to suppress voting. The U.S. holds only one national popular vote. That one for president and vice president. And the Republican Party has won that national vote only once since 1988. That's 32 years. Think about that. And yet, they've held the presidency nearly 12 of those years. And as a result, they dominate the Supreme Court. They currently also hold 50 Senate seats, though they've received millions fewer votes than the Democrats in Senate elections. The Senate map gives rural areas 2.5 times the voting power of big cities, meaning Democrats need to win Senate races by 6 to 7 points. Under the two most recent popular vote losers who won the presidency through the Electoral College, we've suffered the terror attacks of 9/11, the unending and unwinnable wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Great Recession of 2008, the failed response to the COVID-9 pandemic, and the devastated economy. In addition to the Electoral College, Republicans used gerrymandering and voter suppression to thwart the will of the people. In the 2018 midterms in Wisconsin, Democrats swept narrow victories in the statewide races and secured 53% of the votes cast in elections for the lower house of the state legislature. But because of gerrymandering, the GOP won more than 60% of the seats. Knowing they'd be insulated from public backlash, the legislature held a special lame duck session during which they stripped power from the state executive branch and reassigned it to themselves. Something similar happened in Michigan and in North Carolina 2 years earlier. I believe that sustained minority rule not only produces unpopular policies, but also weakens and sickens democracy, breeding cynicism, resignation, and the sorts of tribal divisions that we now face. Today, I turn to an expert on these issues, Dave Daly, who has not only charted the worst of the Republicans' efforts in his bestseller, Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, but also draws hope from the people and actions he writes about in Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. And that book, Unrigged, is now out in paperback, updated through the 2020 election. Former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, Daly's work on voting rights and related issues has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many other publications. He's taught journalism and political science as a fellow at Wesleyan University, Boston College, and the University of Georgia, and he is a senior fellow at Fair Vote. Welcome, David Daly, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Thanks for having me on, Terrence.
Let me tell listeners we're recording this conversation Wednesday, March 24th. I like listeners to get a feel for the people, not just the ideas and the work that we talk about. So can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you find yourself doing today? And feel free to go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Oh gosh, you know, that's
I know.
That's a great question. You know, I was doomed to a life in journalism when my parents let me stay up way too late in the 1970s when All the President's Men was showing as the movie of the week. And they let me stay up late and watch the end of it. And I was hooked on the power of the media to tell the truth and tell stories and change our politics and change our nation for the better, and became determined to head down that path. And it's amazing how sometimes the decisions you make at age 7 or 8 stay with you even 4 decades later, you know, and here we are. But I mean, really, I was editor-in-chief of Salon in 2012, 2013. And what kind of got me going down the road on voting rights and gerrymandering, because nobody sets out to become, you know, an expert on partisan gerrymandering or imagine that, you know, that's the work you're going to spend much of the next decade on. But it all really started quite simply. I asked a simple question one day, as we were in the middle of covering what seemed to me to be absolute chaos and extremism in the U.S. House at Salon, the, you know, 4 dozen votes to repeal Obamacare, a government shutdown. I had grown up in Connecticut, and we had just had our son, and so the deaths at Sandy Hook, it really struck me in a deep way, as did just the absolute inability of our government to do anything on gun control, even in the midst of a massacre of kindergartners and first graders.
Right. And just let me cut in and say, you know, we're speaking today, as I said, March 24th, with the Atlanta and Boulder mass shootings within the last few days. We will see if somehow something can be different.
And really the question I asked at that time was, why didn't Democrats take back the U.S. House in 2012 when Barack Obama is reelected by basically a similar margin that he won office in 2008, slightly smaller, but and Democrats actually gained seats in the U.S. Senate in 2012. But Republicans were sitting on this 234-201 majority in the House. And I thought, that's kind of interesting. And I just looked first at some of the congressional delegations. And I said, oh, how is it possible that Ohio is a 12-4 Republican delegation? How is it possible that Pennsylvania is 13-5? And North Carolina is 9-4, and Michigan is 9-5. A lot of those states went for Obama in 2008 and 2012.
And even if not going for Obama, those are...
They were 50-50 competitive
states. I was just going to say, those are 50-50 states, yeah.
And I thought, you know, 12-4, 13-5, that's 70-75%. And I stumbled accidentally across this website that the Republican State Leadership Committee had put up for the annual report for something called Red Map, the Redistricting Majority Project. And, you know, again, I was the editor-in-chief of Salon. I was editing, you know, Steve Kornacki and Joan Walsh and, you know, Brian Beutler and all of these folks. And we hadn't written about Red Map. I hadn't seen this in any of the newspapers. And I came into work the next day and I said, you know, hey, I think we got to talk about gerrymandering. You know, it turns out Democrats won 1.4 million more votes in 2012, but Republicans have the House. Why don't we write about this? And they all looked at me like I was a flat earther, you know, seriously. They said, come on, David, that's so unsophisticated. Everybody knows that the problem of gerrymandering is not really it. It's geography. It's that Democrats self-sort into cities and Republicans are just more efficiently spread out. There was a, you know, a big book on this by Bill Bishop in the last decade. And it was kind of the, you know, trendy in vogue idea amongst the political smarts.
Let me cut in for 1 second. My jaw just dropped, not at what you brought to them, but at that reaction. I'm amazed how it was. And on the other hand, it also shows how far we've come. As you point out, you know, baseball managers will now gerrymander their bullpen. I mean, people know at least that this evil exists.
I think that's right. You know, and so I said, no, I mean, that there's this website that the Republicans put up and they claim credit for taking over state legislatures in 2010, winning every single seat at the table when it came time to redraw the new district lines in 2011, and then locking themselves into maps that provided a firewall, a seawall against a Democratic wave. And then there was a Democratic wave in 2012, a 1.4 million vote wave that these district lines in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, Florida, state after state, and states that we, you know, keep talking about over the course of the last decade, when it comes to their competitiveness and when it comes to voter suppression tactics, had in their state legislatures and in their congressional delegations been so severely gerrymandered that Democrats effectively had zero chance of winning even when they won a big majority of votes. And when no one else decided to write about it, I thought I would.
Yeah. I thought we might come to this particular thing I'm going to bring up right now, which is to talk about 2010. You know, later in the conversation, but since your biography sets us here, let's do it. I have long said, you know, and I'm probably not the only one at this point, that one of the most impactful political errors I've ever seen was the failure of Obama and the Democrats to focus immediately on the 2010 midterms, knowing that they would determine, and one thing you didn't even mention for those who aren't aware of this, that when those decisions are made in the 10 years, that is to say 2010, 2020, 2000, they are set for 10 years. So the scope, the impact of that is enormous. And knowing that they would determine the state legislatures who would redistrict all the states, they took their eye completely off the ball. Nothing to me was more critical in terms of salving democracy. And yet Obama basically disbanded the campaign's grassroots organizing organization rather than supporting it and aiming it at the midterms. And now I'm just going to give a little background I learned from the research I was doing to prepare for this, just to fatten it up for, you know, to throw it to you. In the Wall Street Journal in March 2009, Karl Rove outlined what you described, REDMAP, Republicans, the redistricting majority project, REDMAP, led by former RNC chairman Ed Gillespie, funded with $30 million kicked in by Fortune 500 mega players like Walmart, Reynolds American, Pfizer, AT&T, and Citigroup, together with mainline GOP stalwarts, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Blue Cross Blue Shield, my insurer of all things. This coordinated campaign flooded lower-profile races with negative ads and defeated Democratic incumbents amid a surging wave of anti-Affordable Care Act and Tea Party protests. And today, more than 50 million Americans, nearly one in five, live in a state in which one or both chambers of the legislature are controlled by the party that won fewer votes. One in five, 50 million Americans, the legislature is controlled by the party that won fewer votes. And in every case, it's the Republicans who hold that power. Harvard's Electoral Integrity Project rated the integrity of these legislative boundaries as a 3 and a 4, respectively, on a scale of 100, a magnitude lower than Iran and Venezuela. The question, I assume you agree with me, one of the greatest political errors we've seen in our lifetimes. How, as you went back and investigated, how did this happen? How did they, who had seemed so astute in winning the 2008 election completely miss this?
Oh, it's a great question. And we're living with the consequences of that failure now, heading into a second decade of Republican advantage.
Yes, my next question is going to be, how did we do in 2020 and what can we look forward to? But let's handle this one first.
And so here's what I would say, because I do think that it is political incompetence of the highest order on the fact of the Democratic Party not to recognize the importance of the 2010 midterms and not to invest in state legislative races and to miss Red Map when Karl Rove, the party's leading strategist, laid out the entire operation on the pages of one of the country's leading newspapers. You know, to have not picked up your newspaper that day, and we are now living in, you know, Jim Crow 2.0 as a result. And I think you can blame Barack Obama for some of this, certainly. But, I mean, Obama is president of the United States. He's working to, you know, pass the Affordable Care Act.
And let's remember, he is also trying to take the country back from the worst crash since up to that point since the Depression.
He most certainly is.
Yeah, you know, so his eye is on, he's got a lot of things going on. So it's,
I spent a lot of time with Eric Holder writing Unrigged. And I asked Holder one day, I said, when did you first hear the word Red Map? Mm. And his answer, I think, was kind of astounding. He said that not long after the 2012 election.
Ooh. That first time.
Not long after the 2012 election, he said, he went to the Oval Office and had a meeting with Obama, and they were going through the numbers in the same way that I guess I was when I was trying to figure out what happened. And they thought that they'd had a pretty good election night on 2012, and they didn't understand why the coattails didn't reach into states like North Carolina, and why the party did so poorly in state legislatures as well. And he said that Red Map was not something he had thought about. It was on the periphery of things. And here they are, 2 years after that election, kind of being blindsided by what had happened in 2010 and 2011 that set the events in motion that led to the down ballot rout of Democrats in 2012, even as they won the White House again, even as they expanded their gains in the U.S. Senate. And I think if you want to understand this, you've got to understand the desperation on behalf of the Republican Party after 2008. Democrats, after the 2008 elections, not only take the White House, they've got a supermajority in the U.S. Senate. They've got more than 240 seats in the U.S. House. And you've got the smartest minds in American politics talking about the demographic changes in the country that could render the Republicans a minority party for a generation to come. Their backs are completely up against the wall. They've just crashed the economy. They have launched these...
Right.
They've launched these inept and unpopular wars, and they don't know what their path back to power is going to be. And so Chris Jankowski, who is this savvy political strategist at the Republican State Legislative Committee, is reading an article in the New York Times one day about how the census is coming up in 2010, and that the governors and the state legislatures elected that year will have outsized influence over redistricting. And he thinks to himself, wait a second, that's our path back to power. And so Republicans needed this strategy more at a time when Democrats thought that they led this inevitable coalition of a rising new American demographics that was just going to install them in office election after election.
Yeah.
Republicans had to think it through a little bit more, and they did.
Yeah. And now this is the point also at which the Republicans do that sort of self-assessment. And the one we hear about, if we're not sitting in Chris Jankowski's office, is, oh, we've got to find a way to appeal to Latinos. And we've got, right? There was that whole thing of that we've got
the autopsy.
The autopsy. And we've got to
healthy parties don't have autopsies.
Right. And of course, the real story is the one you just told. And so it seems like it is both a product, although still blame aplenty to the Democrats, but a product of overconfidence on one side and desperation on the other.
I think that's right. And so after 2012, you've got a Republican Party that can't understand why they don't ever win the White House, and they commissioned the autopsy to try to figure out why young voters and minority voters don't want anything to do with them. And they come back with all of these recommendations for how they have to begin to, you know, talk to voters and develop policies for that might appeal to these groups. You know, the basic idea of politics.
Yeah, exactly.
These guys won't vote for us. Why won't these people vote for us? And what can we do to perhaps earn the votes in the future? Except the problem is the Republicans' die had already been cast. They had already chosen red map. They had already chosen redistricting. And even by 2012, they had changed the nature of the party in state legislatures and also in Congress. You had created all of these safe Republican districts in which all of the power was hard right. And if Republicans didn't understand this in early 2013, they certainly understood it by the spring of 2014 when Eric Cantor is defeated in a primary in Virginia. He is in the leadership of the Republican Party. He is knocked out. And what I think nobody understood in the Republican Party, even back then, is I like to tell the story of Asheville, North Carolina, and North Carolina's 11th district, which had been throughout the 2000s, it had been a swing district. It's a Republican seat in 2002 and 04. It goes Democratic in the wave in 06. The Democrats hold it in 6, 8, and 10, kind of a conservative Democrat has got it. And this used to be a district that included Asheville, a liberal hippie vegan college town in the western mountains of North Carolina, and also the sort of more conservative mountain towns around there that hid Eric Rudolph, the Atlanta abortion bomber, early back. So you know it's a very conflicted political area, makes for a good competitive election.
Right.
And so when Republicans took over the North Carolina House in 2010 as a result of Red Map, they wanted to draw a congressional map that would result in 10 Republicans and 3 Democrats being elected. In order to do this, they had to take this competitive seat out in the western part of the state and make it a guaranteed Republican district. And the way they did this was by cracking Asheville in half, essentially diluting it, putting half of those voters in the 10th district, half of them in the 11th, and creating two solid conservative districts. Except when you do that, you lose control over who gets elected because you have limited this to just the activist primary base of the Republican Party in this mountainous southern area. A man who is the proprietor of a sandwich shop in the mountains of North Carolina decides he's going to run for this seat. He runs for this seat as a hard right birther when somebody asks him at a rally in North Carolina in the middle of this campaign about Barack Obama's citizenship. He says, when I get elected, I'm going to send Barack Obama back to Kenya or wherever it is he comes from.
Oh my.
In that moment, Mark Meadows is on his road to real political power in Washington.
And for
Meadows,
I was going to say, for anyone who knows the name is familiar but is trying to place it, tell them who he goes on to become.
Mark Meadows, after three terms in Congress, in which, well, perhaps four terms in Congress, in which he is no more a friend of John Boehner and Paul Ryan and the Republican establishment as he is a Barack Obama. He runs the House Freedom Caucus, which leads, he helps push out John Boehner as Speaker of the House. He helps create a government shutdown. And then he becomes Donald Trump's chief of staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mark Meadows is created by the Republican gerrymandering of 2010. This is the Frankenstein's monster that is set loose on our politics by the extreme partisan gerrymanders of that year.
And let me just thank you. Those details, those backstories are the things that, you know, that I've missed along the way. But let me just read again some stuff I learned from you, but I'm going to quote Bill Kristol. Because what you're talking about when you say that if you take primaries and you multiply them times gerrymandering, you kind of get these feedback loops that it gets more and more extreme, the voter that you need to reach. And Bill Kristol, longtime neoconservative, power, you know, intellectual power in the Republican Party, says we lost faith in democracy. We lost faith that we could compete for votes and win elections. Therefore, you got to start restricting the electorate. That's very bad for democratic principles and very bad for a political party. First, we're going to gerrymander. Then we're going to suppress the votes in inner cities. Then we're going to discredit mail-in voting. It's all of a piece in terms of the unwillingness to value a fair, open, and legitimate intellectual process. So it isn't just the Democrats or even, let's say, the people of America who kind of are the victims or rue what has happened, but even the Republican establishment.
Yes, I think that the Republican establishment did not fully understand that they were very much creating a Frankenstein's monster and sicking it upon themselves in addition to the entire nation. I think Crystal's got it right there. I think that's the second piece of this, right? It starts with the gerrymandering. And then it moves into the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Shelby County versus Holder in 2013 that effectively undoes preclearance of the Voting Rights Act. It effectively takes down Sections 4 and 5, which had forced localities that had a history of racist voting suppression to preclear any changes in their voting plans with either the Department of Justice or a court in Washington, D.C.
Remind people, this is part of the Voting Rights Act that is part of the civil rights legislation of the Johnson administration, right? And this has been, it's been the way things have gone since the mid-60s until 2013.
That's exactly right. And the Voting Rights Act is in many ways this is the piece of legislation that makes America a democracy, finally, mm-hmm. In 1965, by finally reasserting and insisting that every vote count and does away with, you know, poll taxes and literacy tests and sort of all of the, you know, measures of intimidation and violence that had continued to exist, especially across the American South, but nationwide. And Section 5, in many ways, is the teeth of mm-hmm. the Voting Rights mm-hmm. Act. It took these localities with this noxious history and said, you can't be trusted, effectively, to change the rules on elections on your own. And if you want to do this, you're going to have to prove that it does not have a racist effect. And what the Supreme Court says in 2013, John Roberts, in his ruling, says, well, it's not 1965 any longer, and America has changed. We no longer need this outdated set of protections. And so John Roberts, I think, is incredibly wrong in that.
Right. Let me just, I want to make sure that you go to one place that, with some more information I learned from you. Yeah, you have a quote here that Roberts said, Section 5 is based on 40-year-old facts having no logical relation to the present day. And my God, if you could talk to Stacey Abrams, I think she'd disagree with that. But you point out that it wasn't so long ago that Sensenbrenner, a Republican, had found 12,000 pages of hearings that demonstrated that things hadn't changed as much as Roberts thought they had. Explain that, bring that story in here.
The Voting Rights Act is reauthorized by Congress in 2005 and 2006, and it almost seems like a fever dream, right? Because
yes,
it's practically a unanimous decision. It is unanimous in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, 98 and it's something to nothing. Yes.
And it's something like 385 to 24 in the U.S. House. This is not close. It's not even a debate. And if you want to understand how far backwards we've come in 15 years, all you have to do is look at the difference in the debate over the Voting Rights Act versus the debate in Congress right now over H.R.
1,
the For the People Act. But John Roberts at the U.S. Supreme Court had been hostile to the Voting Rights Act ever since he arrived in Washington back in the early 80s as a young aide at the Justice Department. And so people were looking ahead and aware that there could be challenges, especially to preclearance, that would be arriving at the court, and that this was a newly conservative court, and that there were many conservative states and localities who were chafing after 40 years of having to run these bills past Washington. And so they developed a 12,000-page record of why the Voting Rights Act was still very much needed in present day. And they documented around the country, in all of these states, a very real and shocking and voluminous record of what the Voting Rights Act was in fact protecting right here, right now, in this America. Not in 1965 America, but in America at the time that this debate was going on in Congress. And for John Roberts to ignore all of that, the fact that America had not changed, we learned that very afternoon that the U.S. Supreme Court issues their ruling in Shelby County and putting an end to preclearance. The state of Texas is ready for this and announces that they will begin enforcement immediately of a voter ID provision that they knew full well would keep 600,000 registered Latinos in the state who were correctly and validly registered, but didn't have the specific ID forms that the state would now require from voting. America had changed so much that it took a couple of hours for these states to begin racist voter suppression efforts.
And is that the one where your concealed carry ID will work, but your student ID, if you happen to go to the University of Texas in Austin, won't?
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay, let me tell people that I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking, you're listening to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm speaking today with David Daley, former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, author of Rat Effed, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, and Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. And Unrigged is recently out in paperback, and the paperback version has been updated through the 2020 election. And you can follow Dave on Twitter, at Dave Daley, D-A-L-E-Y, 3, at Dave Daley 3. Oh, God, where do we go from here? I want to get to the unrigged good news, but I think we may have to deal with just a little bit more of the bad news. What you've done for me in your book and then today is really a flesh out kind of the skeleton that I know is there. And one thing, you agree with my analysis that primaries always have favored the most dedicated of your voters, and they may very well be the most extreme. So you may get the most progressive Democrats and the most right-wing Republicans, but gerrymandering sort of, takes that fact and just pumps it up by X number of times, right? And it's the one feeding on the other that keeps pulling us further and further apart.
I think that's right. I think whenever you have districts that are that uncompetitive, you have lawmakers who become incentivized to protect only their base at the farthest end of either side of the spectrum. And what that means in the end is that you have lawmakers who are, less inclined to try and work together and solve problems. And I'm not arguing on behalf of some sort of mushy centrism here. I'm simply suggesting that the system has broken down and become dysfunctional, and that it's become deeply unproportional. And that we've got a lot of work to do in order to try and produce a governing system that is actually capable of creating action on issues that the American people care about.
Right. In other words, one of the other things we know is that whether it's gun control,
right,
or it's health care, or
voting rights, or immigration,
the public is, on a range of from a majority to a large majority in favor of those things, but they are not represented by their state legislatures or by their senators and to some extent their House. One thing I want to make sure we do before we end is look at how we did in state legislature elections in 2020. Just reminding that those elected in the state legislatures in 2020 will be the ones who, for the most part, that is in most states that haven't altered their systems, for the most part, will choose, will district, or shall we say redistrict their states for the next 10 years. Now remember, no matter what happens to the demographics, no matter what happens to the existential crises we face, whether it's racial justice or pandemics or climate change, those new districts will rule for 10 years. How did we do in state legislative elections in 2020? I always hope 2020 was worse because it was a midterm and that favors Republicans and that it would be more even in a presidential election year. How bad was it?
Democrats didn't have a very good year in 2020 in state legislatures. And it's not like 2010. It's not because they didn't understand the importance or fight really hard, but it's because these maps were almost impossible to overcome in state after state after state. The maps have held for a decade, and they're about to bestow upon Republicans another decade of political power in many of these most competitive states.
Let me jump in. We've been talking about redistricting as if it mostly applied to Congress, but it also applies to the state legislative districts. And that's the point you're just making.
That's exactly right. All of this begins with state legislatures, because in most states, that's who draws the lines for themselves, and it's who draws the lines for Congress. And then it's also those same state legislatures that work on voter ID laws or make it harder to vote absentee or eliminate days of early voting or get rid of automatic voter registration. So state legislatures are incredibly important. Now, Democrats are going to be in a little bit better shape in 2020 than they were in 2010, simply because they have won governorships in some of these key swing states, like Michigan and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. So Democrats may be able to at least have a seat at the table and mitigate some of the extremism that seeped into these maps over the course of the last decade.
Yeah, two things, let me say. One, again, a governor is to a state as a presidency is to the nation. It's a statewide election, so you can't gerrymander it.
And so Democrats could actually win those elections in states, those
states where they have, where the voters prefer them. And so that's just so now. In the states where Republicans have managed to get a supermajority, then they probably can overcome even vetoes from those governors. But there probably aren't either. But in other states where they just have undeserved majorities, if you will, the governor should have power to mitigate the problem.
I think that's right. So Texas, North Carolina, Florida, Georgia. Democrats are going to be without a seat at the table once more. In Pennsylvania, they will have a governor who can veto an unfair map. In Wisconsin, they could have a governor who can veto an unfair map. But, you know, Republicans had the power in 2011 to draw 193 of the 435 U.S. House seats on their own. They will only have the ability in 2021 to draw 181 on their own. So I'm not going to say it's as bad, but it's not much better.
No. I knew that was where we were going, and it just sickens me. But as you point out, the mistake you made in 2010 haunts you. Because, as you point out, those state legislative districts that might have been competitive in 2010 were gerrymandered so that they weren't. And so now in 2020, throw your best efforts, throw your best candidates, have all sorts of good things happen, and you still lose where the population numbers and the voting numbers do not represent the elected numbers.
In 2010, 12, 14, 16, 18, and 2020, Democrats did not win back a single chamber of the state house or the state senate in Florida, in Georgia, in North Carolina, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, or in Wisconsin. Not even in years where they won hundreds of thousands more votes. The lines that were drawn in 2011 held for a decade, and in many cases will continue to define our politics throughout the 2020s.
Oh, God. I want to switch to Unrigged, the good news. But my last question is, what about the courts? Because a parallel effort by the Republican Party to, solidify and buttress these efforts they're making for gerrymandering, voter suppression, and so on, is the campaign, spearheaded by the Federalist Society, which has now been going on since the 70s, I believe, to put kind of almost their number one priority besides voting rules is judges. And how will that, how do we stand in terms of that affecting what might be things that come out of this redistricting effort in 2021?
Well, you know, I'm sounding pretty doom and gloom today, right? The U.S. Supreme Court back in 2019, in a case called Common Cause versus Rucho, they closed the doors to partisan gerrymandering claims. They called them non-justiciable and a political issue. And so citizens and reformers won't be able to challenge partisan gerrymanders in federal court over the course of this next decade. They will still be able to do so in state court, and there's been some luck there. Democrats and reformers and good government groups have won new maps in North Carolina and Pennsylvania by doing challenges under state constitutions that oftentimes have a broader and more expansive definition of voting rights than the U.S. Constitution. But, you know, it's very true, you know, even H.R. 1, if it passes, and any challenges that voting rights groups make against some of the suppression efforts in state legislatures that are going on right now, they're going to head into courts that where the judiciary is much more conservative over the course of the last 4 years and the success that Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump had, you know, first in holding up a lot of Obama appointments at the end of his term, and then in filling all of those appointments, you know, not only on the U.S. Supreme Court, but
the district courts,
the federal circuit, district courts,
is
nationwide, right? And what you clearly see is that there is a U.S. Supreme Court that appears much more hostile to voting rights than any time in modern history. Whenever there appears to be a case before them in which you've got two different views of democracy, they tend to side with the one making it harder for people to get to the polls. You know, but certainly during the 2020 election, you know, many of the wildest claims were tossed aside by those same courts. So I think we ought to at least retain some of our optimism there.
Very good. Okay, so Unrigged, the book that's recently out in paperback, features, it's got a theme of Americans fighting back against kind of everything we've been talking about so far. But it also features stories of individuals working for change. Can you share a couple of those stories?
Yeah, I would love to. And I'm sorry to anyone out there who's begun the process of slitting your wrists after listening to us for the last 35 or 40 minutes. Imagine being me for all of this time. You know, I'm going around talking about Radeft, and I'm giving these talks, and, you know, oftentimes it's to these groups of really kind, earnest reformers who maybe got interested in politics after 2016, and sometimes I would just suck the air out of the room. Oh my gosh, you know. And I needed, for my own sake, but also to feel like, you know, we didn't need another book about how democracies die. We had plenty of those. What I wanted to do was chronicle a roadmap back. How do we get the kind of government that we actually want to represent us? And as I looked around the country, I just saw so many examples of individuals standing up and taking on these structural fights that the political parties and the pundits and the experts all said were too hard, too difficult. You can't win. Why are you bothering? And so, you know, Katie Fahey is a 27-year-old woman in Michigan who, 2 days after the 2016 election in Michigan, she posts to Facebook, I want to do something about gerrymandering in Michigan. If you want to do this too, reach out and join me. And she is in a family of all kinds of mixed politics, and she was thinking ahead to Thanksgiving, and that there was going to be Trump voters and Hillary fans and Bernie supporters, and there's going to be mashed potatoes flying through the air, right? And she's like, what is something that maybe we can all agree on? And she's thinking it's gerrymandering. You know, let's fight for fair districts and meaningful elections and a voice for everyone. And this Facebook post takes off, and Katie's not involved in politics. She was, she worked for a recycling plant in Grand Rapids. She had no idea what the next steps were. But as so many people reached out, she decided she would learn. And she's like, well, we're going to need to get about 400,000 signatures in order to put this on the ballot. And there were six or seven of them. And they said, okay, that's about 80,000 signatures each. Here we go. And they started and they built this movement and they generated tens of thousands of volunteers. They went out and they got those 430,000 signatures. It becomes the first time in Michigan history that an initiative makes the ballot without paid signature gatherers going
out
and collecting them. And in November of 2018, they won with more than 61% of the vote. And so right now, you've got a commission in Michigan that's going to draw lines when 10 years ago, you had Republican lawmakers and strategists drawing those lines. Democrats won the statewide popular vote for the state house every single year in the last decade, and they never took control of the chamber. You're going to have fair maps in Michigan as a result of what these citizens did. I went out to Idaho, and I mean, Idaho, right? I mean,
yeah.
As red as a state can get. You're talking Taylor Swift lipstick red out in Idaho. This is a one-party state. And yet they voted in 2018, more than 64% of the state, to expand Medicaid, something that the Republican legislature there would not do 6 years in a row. And this started because a handful of young people decided that they also wanted to try and do a statewide ballot initiative. And they started a group called Reclaim Idaho, and they bought an old RV, this rickety 40-year-old RV, and they painted it green, and they took off gathering signatures in every part of the state, just driving with this, you know, crazy rolling billboard for Medicaid expansion. And you would imagine that you can't find, you know, enough people in Idaho who are going to vote for this. You would be wrong, because Idaho is a rural state, and rural healthcare and rural hospitals are a huge issue. There's a lot of poverty, a lot of people who had fallen in between the gaps, a lot of hardworking people who fell in between the gaps of the state exchanges and the federal exchange, tens of thousands of them who didn't have healthcare, and they won, and they won big. You know, it's not even close. It's a sign, again, of what we were talking about earlier, about how these one-party legislatures oftentimes are enforcing a really rigid sense of politics when even in a place like Idaho, expanded health care is popular and the people want it. And this is what it took to make it happen. And on the eve of a pandemic, I think we ought to be more glad than ever that these citizens were able to step up and do this. But if you can win like that in Michigan, if you can win like that in Idaho, you can really see how there's a roadmap forward for honest change.
So it really, in both of those cases, what it really is it's individuals. It's really grassroots, and to some extent even people who haven't been professional grassroots in the past, if you will, but that they can make a difference against all this behind the scenes dealing that we've been suffering from for decades.
They most certainly can. You know, you could see it in Florida, right?
With the
initiative
on
felon reenfranchisement, a state which had embraced this Jim Crow era restriction 130 years ago and had 1.4 million people in the state who had been convicted of a crime, served their time, but had been unable to regain their voice. And Democrats in the state had tried to do something about this on multiple occasions in the past and simply been unable to ever get it through. It took citizens. It took a Democrat in Desmond Meade and a Republican in a man named Neil Volz who were able to sort of form this moral coalition, and they unite left and right, and they unite black and white, and radical criminal justice reformers and Florida churchgoers who believe in second chances. They're funded by the ACLU and the Koch brothers.
Wow.
And they built this coalition that in Florida won more than 63% of the vote in 2018. And 2018 in Florida, right, is the year in which Rick Scott barely wins his seat in the U.S. Senate, and Ron DeSantis barely wins
right.
his seat for governor. But giving people who had a felony conviction in their past their right to vote was not controversial.
Yeah.
That wins at 63%, and Ron DeSantis wins at 50.005, right?
Got it. Yep.
It's a sign that when it comes to these issues of basic fairness, most Americans, even in a state like Florida, even in Idaho, aren't looking at this through a partisan lens.
Mm-hmm.
These issues can unite Americans of all kinds.
Okay. I was going to say, I give you a minute to make a closing statement, but you almost just did. I mean, it really is that, isn't it? It's that the people, it's harder, but the people can, step by step, effort by effort, doorbell by doorbell, email by email, Facebook post by Facebook post, battle back.
I think you're right. And I think that this becomes the defining battle of our times in many ways. You know, these activists, these volunteers, they show that all of us have got the ability to make great change ourselves, that we don't need superheroes or the perfect candidate in order to do it. I mean, John Lewis, in that masterful essay that he wrote in the New York Times that was published posthumously after his death last year, talked about how voting is good trouble,
mm-hmm.
right? That you can lose your right to vote if you do not hold on to it and protect it. And I think along those lines, we have to think about democracy as being a verb, being an action, something that all of us are responsible to do and to tend. And when you consider it in that respect and look at the life of John Lewis, somebody who had the ability to persevere and find courage in the hardest, most difficult moments, you understand that this capacity to create change does lie within all of us, that there is an unrigging of our politics that can be underway if all of us step forward together and fight for the kind of country we want to live in.
Thank you, David. So again, the latest book is Unrigged. It's now out in paperback, updated through the 2020 election. You can follow Dave Daley on Twitter at Dave Daley, D-A-L-E-Y, at Dave Daley 3. At Dave Daley 3 on Twitter. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 articles that are timely and relevant, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and at other major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts at my site. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Greg Boyle, Connie Rice. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence, McNallyTerrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, David Daley. Keep up the good work.
Thanks for having me on, Terrence. It just might work indeed.
Excellent.